Amisa the Buddha, Amisa the Dharma, Amisa the Sangha. Yesterday, we got to the point in the Sandokai where two of the really great metaphors are used. The baby returning to its mother, the baby in its relationship to its mother, the leaves in a relationship to the root. Both metaphors showing exactly the same thing, that what we tend to think of as most real which is the world of the senses, is not really the most real. What is most real is the eternal. And the world of multiplicity, the world of our experience, the world of the transitory, is, as it were, the external appearance of the great unity, the great oneness of the eternal, of the Buddha nature. And it's because of this that the eternal is always a refuge for us. Never actually remote. Our perception may be, our feeling, our thought may be that the eternal is remote. In actual fact, that's just our thought, our perception, our feeling. The reality is that nothing could be closer. We are not it, it is all of us. I am not him, he is all of me. And these two metaphors convey this quite vividly, I think. We now come back to what is the essential metaphor, the central metaphor and the chief metaphor of this poem, the light and dark metaphor. This is a metaphor which is used to generalize the teaching here. So he goes on to say, within all light is darkness, but explained it cannot be by darkness that one-sided is alone. In darkness there is light, but here again by light one-sided it is not explained. Now, if we were to stop and think for a moment, think like someone who's never come to this poem before. Most of us listening to this have recited it many, many, many times indeed. One could be saying to oneself, well, whatever light and darkness stand for, not only has it never occurred to me that they need to be explained in terms of each other, but I don't know why anyone would want to. But let's look a little bit more at what the word explained here means. Remember, our master is translating Chinese characters, and this is a very difficult thing to do. At the best you can get, much of the time is a kind of approximation. So let's change, explain. She's further, by the way, she's further confined by the fact that this is a poem and she's trying to be true to the poetic nature of it and make something that we could recite. I can't imagine anyone doing better than River Master has done with our scriptures. We're fortunate she's a great artist as well as a very great spiritual teacher. She rendered them into poems that are beautiful and easy to recite, flow naturally, and set them to music that works well with them. But all of that constrains one. And so let's change the word explain to something else for a moment. So, let's go back here. Within all light is darkness. Remember light and darkness, what's the metaphor stand for? Let's say light here, the multiplicity of our experience. Let's just substitute something simpler than that. Within our ordinary daily life, within our humanity, is darkness. Within all aspects of ordinary daily life, within all aspects of our humanity, there is the Buddha nature. Light, remember multiplicity, the world of the senses, the world of our experience, sense experience, the world of ordinary daily life, dark, the undifferentiated oneness of the eternal. The oneness of a love which doesn't know how not to love. A love that is beyond all opposites. A love that can't be made to hate. So, within our humanity, every aspect of it, there is the Buddha nature. But you can't understand your humanity just by reference to the Buddha nature. Why is that? Well, everything in me, everything in you is of the eternal. And I and you are not God. No matter how far we go in the spiritual life, we're always subject to the law of karma. We can never get rid of our humanity. And it is not the purpose of the spiritual life to get rid of our humanity. You never can kill the self. Self may be an illusion, but still you can't kill it. River Master used to caution us again and again, don't try to kill the self. You're trying to train it. You're trying to undergo conversion. You're not trying to cut off or kill any part of yourself. What happens if we ignore this teaching? What if we try to just apply the understanding of oneness to our humanity? Well, you end up in a worse state than you ever started in, very possibly. This can very well end up in what Ramaswamy used to call love and light delusion. Remember the Beatles song, "Love is All You Need." Well, as I sometimes say, God is love. But love is not God. And we must never make the mistake of getting things reversed there. It is not for any human being to try to storm the infinite and possess love and try to be the love of the eternal. We cannot be Kanzeon. We are not God. Yes, all beings have the Buddha nature, and in fact, that infinite love of which we speak, the infinite wisdom is the true nature of all things, and is accessible to all who turn towards it with humility and willingness, and who are willing to pay the price that has to be paid. To reharmonize with it. And no one can say truthfully, I have mastered it, I own it. We are not God. Always, as Kazan said, we are in the position of a disciple. We begin as a disciple to a human master, longing in our heart to realize oneness with the eternal. And the oneness that we can realize as a human being is going to be the oneness of a disciple. Disciple of the eternal. A listener to the eternal. A follower of the eternal. Not someone who gets enlightened and then just grabs the reins and runs off. Following their own opinions. That's not true enlightenment. Always there is someone senior to ourselves. Always we're in the position of a disciple. He goes on to say, in darkness there is light. But here again, by light one-sided, it is not explained. Using our little kind of translation formula here. Within the oneness of the eternal is all the world of multiplicity, is the realm and world of our humanity. But we can never understand the eternal if we try to understand the eternal in terms of our own limited view of things, of our own opinions, of our own perceptions, of our own wishes and longings. We must not drag the eternal, try to drag the eternal down to our level. The eternal cannot be understood in terms of the transitory. Indeed, how are we going to understand the infinite with our little brains? He goes on to say, light goes with darkness as a sequence does of steps in walking. I've always found this a somewhat puzzling, and also the flip side of that is wonderfully helpful and meaningful metaphor. Remember again, this is one of the many metaphors in this poem. He's saying this relationship between our humanity and the eternal, there's something that is like taking steps when we walk. So what can that be? It's not initially real obvious. Well, one way of looking at it, and this is a very helpful way of looking at it, is that in our experience, sometimes the everyday multiplicity side of things is foremost, and sometimes the withdrawing within to stillness and oneness side of things is foremost. And you can see how the rhythm of formal meditation in the schedule of a monastery is meant to coincide as much as possible with the natural rhythm of being drawn out into daily life to do what needs to be done, and then being drawn back within to take refuge in the eternal, to let go of external things. Here's another possible meaning. A two-footed person, let's just say a human being bipeds, we can't do walking without using both feet. Let's leave hopping out of it. We can't walk normally without using both feet. And if we think not in terms of the sequence of steps, but just in the terms of walking, what it is saying then is, in order to not fall into the trap of one-sided clinging, either grasping after external things or grasping after spiritual things, in order to avoid that trap, we need to accept that the all is one and all is different are both always present. There's always going to be the aspect of our humanity, the aspect of ordinary daily life. There's always going to be the aspect of the inner refuge of the Buddha nature. And that together they make up the complete picture. Reverend Master used to say, when I was a young monk, she'd sometimes say, that you have to see with both eyes. One eye seeing the all as one, the other eye seeing the all as different. After all, if you try to function just on the basis of one or the other, you get into trouble. You certainly can't drive a car safely and be clinging to the all as one, because red lights and green lights they're both lights. What's the difference? From the point of view of all the all is one, they're all the same. You have to be able to distinguish between red lights and green lights to drive safely. You have to be able to distinguish between what is wise action and what is unwise action. Whether we act wisely or unwisely, we still have the Buddha nature. And the Buddha nature doesn't stop us from getting the consequences of our actions. And some of the consequences can be very painful. And some of them can be very joyful. Anyone with any sense would prefer not to have any more of the painful ones than necessary. So from this point of view, it's not so much the sequence of steps, it's just the fact that in order to walk, you need to be able to step. In order to be able to walk properly, you need both feet functioning naturally. And you need to be able to rely on both feet. He goes on to say, all things herein have inherent great potentiality. Both function, rest, reside within. Now, for the term function, I like to suggest substituting the word activity. All things herein have inherent great potentiality. Both activity and rest reside within. And I'd like to substitute for the word rest the word stillness. All things herein have inherent great potentiality. Both activity and stillness reside within. And now for residing within, I'd like to substitute have their roots in the Buddha nature. All things herein have inherent great potentiality. Both activity and stillness are rooted in the Buddha nature. So how to live in a way that harmonizes activity and stillness so that there can be the meditative stillness within activity and the proper use of the will within meditation. Both aspects are rooted in the Buddha nature. I mean, if you think of it, what else can residing within mean? What is it that we take refuge in when we turn within? Is in the Buddha nature. What does it mean that all things herein have great potentiality? This is a wonderful line. This is one of the most wonderful teachings in this poem, and one that each of us can and really each of us does, over time, prove true in our own experience, in training. To put it very simply, whether the lines with which we write seem to be straight or whether they seem to be crooked, the Eternal has the last word. Every aspect of existence has inherent great potentiality that comes from the fact that it is rooted in Buddha nature. Thus, however anguished and confused, however horrific the conditions of our life may sometimes be, and one only has to watch the evening news on television to just get a little feel for how bad things can be and how bad things are for people somewhere on this planet at any given moment. But however difficult things may get, what this is saying is the circumstances of this present transitory moment are never the last word. They're never the end of the story. As I have so often said, all the spiritual need, however confused, however anguished, however jangled it may be, will one day get the help that it so longs for. An infinite love of that which is infinite in its existence can wait forever or for a very long time. And one day, someone or some being will inherit even the most confused and jangled and anguished karma and help us find its way back to the resolution that only can be found in the compassion of the Eternal and the wisdom of the Eternal. This is just a part of all things having the Buddha nature. Within all light is darkness. Tomorrow we'll talk about two more of the key metaphors that occur in the Sandokai. You can literally just go through this poem just in terms of its metaphors. This relationship between our humanity and the Eternal, it's like this, it's like this, it's like this, it's like this, it's like this. And each metaphor is revealing more of the picture. It's a wonderful thing, a very helpful thing, to think of this poem in that way. Just kind of abstract from everything else and just think in terms of the metaphor and what the metaphors are saying. And when we think in this way, we're thinking in a way that is closer to the way that the author thought. Of course, in Chinese, these metaphors are conveyed in little formalized pictures in the writing. And this way of writing and this way of thinking and writing by analogy is very conducive to finding complementary meanings. It means this and look, oh look, it means this too. Isn't that wonderful? Rather than conflicting meanings. Oh, it's got to mean this or it can't mean this. It's got to be one or the other. This is very conducive to the and rather than the or. And that's how I'm trying to speak of this scripture.
Homage to all.